The American economy has taken a beating in the last couple of months as the COVID-19 pandemic forced states to issue stay-at-home rules to slow the spread of the virus. Since March, more than 36 million Americans have filed for unemployment compensation. Some businesses, small and large, have been forced into bankruptcy. And all of the gains pretty much made since the Great Recession were erased in a two-month time span. But why wasn't the U.S. economy ready to handle a crisis like this pandemic? And what would need to be changed in order to survive the next one? Our next guest says the pandemic highlights a lot of problems that existed before the disease even started to spread. Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist and a professor at Columbia University. His latest book is People, Power, and Profits: Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent. Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Nice to be here.
Well, your book came out before this pandemic really got rolling, but you were quoted recently in the New York Times talking about the economic impact. I'll throw your quote at you. You said, "We built an economy with no shock absorbers. We made a system that looked like it was maximizing profits, but had higher risks and lower resiliency." Can you spell that out for us a little more on why this pandemic has been such an economic hit?
Well, the point is that our market economy was very short-sighted. We saw that in 2008, where the banks had taken on enormous risk without thinking about the consequences, and we had to come bail the banks out to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. In 2017, we gave our corporations a massive tax cut. And what did they do with it? They could have used that money to invest more. They could have used that money to pay higher wages. They could have used that money to build capital buffers in case some event happened that you can't anticipate. But no, their short-sighted behavior led them to repurchase buyback shares, pay big dividends, pay their CEOs high pay. And the result is that now that the pandemic has struck, they're very ill prepared. They have very little shock absorbers. And that's been an aspect of our entire economy, a focus on short run without thinking about risks or the long-term consequences. Let me give you another example. The number of hospital beds in the United States relative to our population is very low. And you might be surprised, you know, why is that in a rich country? Well, we were very proud at how efficient we were in throwing people out of the hospitals as quickly as they could. And we said we were using our hospital beds very efficiently. All very well and good as long as you don't have a surge like associated with the pandemic. But that means with a surge, there are many places in the country that will be very hard-pressed.
Now, pre-pandemic, the economy, by a lot of measures, was looking like it was doing pretty good, not great, but pretty good for a long period of time from the end of the Great Recession, stock market gradually going up, unemployment gradually going down, average incomes going up. But you write in your book that was masking, you say, a lot of problems underneath those surface numbers. Can you spell out what you saw going wrong, again, even before the pandemic hit the economy?
Yeah, and it's important to realize this was even before the pandemic. One of the things that was that the fruits of this growth were not well shared. We didn't have shared prosperity. The people in the middle of the income, actually the average income, the bottom 90% was stagnating. At the bottom, it was actually declining. Health, obviously an issue brought to the fore by the pandemic. Health in the United States, average life expectancy in the United States is at the bottom of the advanced countries. Inequalities in health are larger than in almost any other advanced country. So we are at the forefront in developing new medicines and doing research, but unable to deliver that to our citizens. And in fact, life expectancy before the pandemic was lower in the United States than it was in 2015. So it showed you things weren't going well in many of the fundamental, you know, people care about their health. And yet for the typical American, things were not going well.
Talking to Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel-winning economist and professor at Columbia University. His latest book is People, Power, and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent. Joseph, we've seen some people embracing various forms of what they call socialism. You are, in this book, making the case for capitalism, a progressive capitalism, but capitalism in general. Make the case there for those people who are thinking, no, capitalism has failed, we're turning to socialism.
Well, the kind of capitalism that we've had for the last 40 years has failed. And so I have a lot of sympathy for those critics. But that's, you know, there are some advantages of markets. In a complex society, large society such as ours, no one can run the whole thing. It has to be decentralized. Markets are going to play a very important role. The question is, we have to move from unfettered markets to well-regulated markets where government plays a very important role in social protection, environmental regulation, ensuring there's competition, and providing some basic things like infrastructure, education, and basic research. You know, nothing has shown the importance of research more than this pandemic. And in spite of the importance of research, the current administration has proposed year after year cutbacks in science, including major cutbacks in the Centers for Disease, CDC, which is at the forefront of trying to control the pandemic.
Yeah, let's talk to the audience on the other side now that might object to the progressive half of progressive capitalism. There is a pretty solid group of people, including in the economics profession, who say, wait a minute, government doesn't do things well. The more they regulate, the worse the market works, and ultimately the worse off everybody is for everything is for everyone. What would you say to them?
Now, I would say nonsense. We paid a very high price for under-regulating the banks. We had to come to rescue the banks to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. And the cost to our society has been in the trillions of dollars. If you look at our growth path before the 2008 crisis, and then you see how it perturbed that growth path, we paid an enormous price for underregulated financial markets. We're paying a very high price for underregulating the environment. Climate change is going apace. It's an existential issue. We can't wish it away. It's not a PR issue. It's a real issue. And we are seeing the consequences. California fires, hurricanes, tornadoes. The damage from these extreme weather events have been in 7 years up to 2% of GDP. We're talking, you know, well over $300 billion. So we're paying a very high price now for underregulating the environment. We're going to be paying an even higher price in the future. I could go through the list, but anybody who tries to deal with their monopoly telephone companies knows about the kind of service that they, the ability of those large companies to exploit them, not to be responsive. It's not. We don't have a competitive marketplace in sector after sector. There are 1, 2, 3 firms, most 4 firms. And when you have that much market power, you don't have low prices, you don't have high levels of innovation, and you don't pay attention to the concerns of your consumers. So it seems to me that it should be perfectly clear that unfettered markets by themselves have been a failure, and they certainly have not produced the kind of prosperity for the average American, for the typical American, that we should expect, given the advances in our technology, given our investments in education, given our overall potential. Large fractions of America have not participated in our prosperity.
effect. We continue our conversation with economist Joseph Stiglitz about why the American economy wasn't prepared for the COVID-19 pandemic and why he says the economy wasn't working for everyone even before the pandemic. His latest book is People, Power, and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent. You can join in with your reactions to what he has to say, your questions for him at 800-642-1234. Do you see inequality as a big problem in the American economy? What do you think, if anything, we should do about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Joseph, so far we've focused mostly on the problems you point out in your book. The second half is all about some solutions. And let's start where we just left off there. You point toward the power of big corporations that dominate particular industries. What do you see as solutions for that?
Well, there we need stronger enforcement of competition. We need new competition laws because the economy is very different from it was at the end of the 19th century when we first adopted our antitrust laws or competition laws. Companies like Google, Facebook, in some ways have more monopoly power, are garnering for themselves more profits, have the ability to exploit consumers with all the information on us that they're gathering than the old industries of the past. So we need new competition laws, and we need to enforce the competition laws that we have more effectively.
You also say that this isn't just an economic problem, it's a political problem. What would you see needing change in the political system to enact some of the economic reforms you're hoping to see?
Well, one aspect is actually related to what we were just talking about. One of the reasons we passed the antitrust law at the end of the 19th century was the worry that the concentration of economic power that was being seen at that time was leading to a concentration of political power. When you have large amounts of inequality, economic inequality, the economic inequality gets translated into political inequality. And that's particularly true more recently in the United States because of some Supreme Court decisions, which have really given money more power in our politics than in other democracies around the world. So the voice of the very wealthy get heard more clearly. And then this is a vicious circle because they then adopt rules that allow them to make more profits. They weaken the antitrust laws. They weaken the laws against discrimination. The result of all of that is even more inequality. So we're in a trap here with more economic inequality leading to more political inequality leading to more economic inequality. And so what I suggest in the book is that we have to get out of that trap by we still have our democracy. There is an attempt by the right, by some of these very powerful forces to engage, to disenfranchise Americans, suppress voting, to disempower, to make it more difficult for there to be true representation of what Americans really want, and constrain our political system, for instance, the rulings of the Supreme Court. So that we are moving from a government that was majority control with minority rights to one in which a minority is actually setting the rules of the game and the majority rights are not being recognized.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ron is with us in Madison. Ron, hi.
Eisenhower is the solution to income inequality and wealth inequality. The top corporate tax rate back then was 52.8%, and for a while the top family rate on income was 94%. We absolutely must reform to keep the federal government from going bankrupt during this pandemic that's likely to last for at least a few years. We also must reform Social Security and Medicare funding so that those remain solvent for more than the next 5 years.
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. Let's start with the taxes side of things. Joseph, what do you think of what Ron was suggesting there?
Well, first let me say that mentioning Eisenhower is really important to realize this was the Republican agenda. And so there really ought to be a bipartisan understanding of these basic precepts. Eisenhower had a very strong expenditure program. He had a national highway program, a national education program, a national research program. So this is not a partisan issue. This is something that should be a basis of agreement among most Americans. I think the point that he makes that going forward, we are going to have to raise taxes. And the question is, who should we raise the taxes on? The United States has a regressive tax system. Those at the top pay actually a smaller percentage of their income than those lower down. It's very unusual for that to be the case, and it's a reflection of this gross political inequality that I referred to earlier. So obviously, the first element in responding to the needs for greater revenue will be to increase the taxes on those who been lucky, been fortunate, worked hard, but have in the end wound up with a much higher ability to pay than those Americans who are struggling on a very limited income. Corporations, we reduced the corporations in December 2017 to a very low level, and we were told it was going to lead to more investment, higher wages. It just led to more share buybacks. Investment has been very anemic, and wages grown a little, but not any faster than would be expected from the stage of the business cycle that we were in. So that shows that the corporate tax cuts didn't do anything positive. Now we need to raise the corporations, particularly the corporations who are making so much profits right now, because they are capable of contributing more to our society than they've been contributing.
You also write in your book, Joseph, that in some ways here in the United States, we've blinded ourselves by a myth that that we do capitalism best. And you say that's led us to ignore some of our problems and some of the possible solutions. Can you spell that out?
Well, as I say, many other countries have market economies that deliver for the average citizen much better. There is a study that asked, you know, if you were going to be born in any country, United States, Norway, Germany, and you didn't know where in the income distribution you were going to be. You have 1% to wind up in the top 1%, 1% to wind up at the bottom 1%, 50% to be in the middle 50%. The answer is, if you knew you were going to be born in the top 1%, America's a great place. But if you don't know where you're going to be born, America's actually pretty bad, because there's a good chance you'll be born in the middle or the bottom, and you're going to do very badly. So other countries have figured out a better job of getting shared prosperity. And this is the striking thing. They've actually been able to grow just as fast as the United States. So there's not a – one of the points that I try to explain, the two myths I tried to destroy. And one is the myth of the American dream, the idea that – America is a country of equal opportunity. The fact is, the United States, the life prospects of a young person are more dependent on the income and education of his parents than in almost any other advanced country. And the second myth that I tried to destroy is the myth of this big trade-off, that you could only get more equality by giving up on economic growth. The IMF, which is not a left-wing organization by any account, has actually shown that, in fact, equality actually promotes economic performance. The two are complements. And so you can actually get a better overall performing economy if you have more equality. Very understandable. And we're seeing it right now in the pandemic. One of the reasons that the United States has such a high death rate is because we have such a poor health system with so much health inequalities.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winning economist and professor at Columbia University, author of the new book, People, Power, and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent.